from the North Carolina Reading Service. For our blind and print-impaired listeners, we now present... The Indie Week. Weekly tabloid, this issue dated June the 16th, 2021, and it's read by John Federson. And our music today actually is in honor of the 17-year cicadas now preparing to hum their way into all our hearts this summer. Today we have a small combo of the little guys. Looks to be about 12 to 13,000 or so getting together. A sort of a reunion tour, our cicada combo. And we'll hear them scratching out some tunes at the end of our hour. And we begin, of course, with an article about Juneteenth, which is coming up in just a couple days officially. By Aya Shabu, writes, Duty Bound. I've noticed that the new white people in my neighborhood all seem to have large dogs. Despite how harmless they profess Fido or Trixie to be, the owner is issuing a not-so-subtle warning. The brand-new 6-foot-tall border wall-like fence in their yard isn't neighborly either. To me, it's a physical and cultural offense. The upcropping of porch flags everywhere reeks of another settler colonial practice. This is the landscape that I'm navigating while passing out Juneteenth flyers to my black neighbors. Feeling overwhelmed by whiteness extends well beyond my neighborhood. Last month, my mother came to visit me from the Northeast. It had been several years, but we went to the Durham Farmers Market to buy chow chow, goat cheese, and banana butter. The demographics of the city's recent population boom were evident that early Saturday morning. While many of the vendors were the same, I missed the black family that sold mini cakes and hand pies, and I noticed that the majority of black vendors were stationed on the outskirts of the main market plaza. What surprised me the most was the overwhelming number of white 30-somethings with infants and toddlers in tow. While we were happy to support local black and white vendors, Mom and I didn't stay long. As I was leaving, I said to a friend on the phone, "Girl, there's hardly any black people here." I don't whisper these truths anymore. An older white person came up to me after overhearing my comment. "Well," they told me, "there's a black farmers market in Raleigh tomorrow." Seemingly well-meaning white folk are so proud of themselves, eager to share their knowledge of black people with me. "Actually, there are plenty of black people here," they added. I was so much kinder in that moment than I wanted to be. "Well, these two of the 5 black people here are leaving." How is it that there are fewer black-owned businesses downtown than there were before the city's revitalization? When I moved to Durham in 2003, the city center was mostly composed of black-owned businesses. In addition to the bank and the post office, I mostly frequented Mr. Scott's one-room tailor shop, the Ethiopian convenience store, Mr. Show clothing store on Main Street, Talk of the Town nightclub, a Kenyan restaurant at 5 Points, Mad Styles Barbershop, and, of course, Ronnie Sturtevant's TQ Business Complex. White and black folk alike in Raleigh were afraid to visit Durham, even during the daylight hours. Back then, blacks make up 43% of the population. Our presence in Durham has been dwindling since 2010, and yet, unsolicited, a white person is quantifying for me just how many black people are enough. There's an inverse relationship between white people's sense of well-being and black folks' access to public space. We might as well be living in the 1950s again. White people continue to take up so much space, and unfortunately, racial equity education has given many of them the language, resources, and entitlement to expand who and what they can control. I, too, am guilty. Since 2012, my social entrepreneurship, Whistle Stop Tours, has guided more than 100 groups through black neighborhoods. I love sharing Durham's history with Black family reunion and rites of passage groups, but the majority of my engagements are contracted for undergraduate classes at PWIs, predominantly white institution, nonprofit retreats, corporate orientations, and research projects assigned by private schools. Over the past 10 years, I've seen heritage tourism become profitable for everyone except the city's most vulnerable residents. I don't blame anyone for wanting to understand their history, but large groups of white people touring black neighborhoods is, more often than not, another hallmark of gentrification. My employer, Village of Wisdom, partners with the Haiti Heritage Center each year for Juneteenth. The Heritage Center's evolution from a brush arbor, a place of worship, to an African Methodist Episcopal Church, Freedmen's School, Civil Rights Organizing Space, and now Performance Hall and Cultural Center still bears the name of the first free black republic in the Western Hemisphere. The island nation of Haiti is a global symbol of black liberation. The Creole spelling of K-R-E-Y-O-L, spelling of Haiti, translated in English as a mountainous land, is an acknowledgement of the indigenous Taino people whose population was decimated to near extinction by Spanish invaders in the 16th century. The descendant community of Haiti resisted a similar settler colonial practice known as urban renewal. In 1975, St. Joseph's AME averted demolition and was added to the North Carolina Register of Historic Spaces. Black people need our own spaces. Segregation forced the creation of many districts like Haiti, Wilmington, and Greenwood that nonetheless thrived until they were targeted by racist violence and the nation's interstate highway system that tore through the heart of those communities. Black holidays, like Juneteenth in Durham and across the country, are our time to come together again. It's a time to pay homage to the Okanichi Band of the Saponi Nation, whose land became a free soil haven for African Americans during Jim Crow terrorism. It's a time to rest from the labor of code switching. We look forward to enjoying dedicated spaces away from the white gaze, oasis spaces where we can express ourselves through our food ways, musical genius, remixed dance styles and fashion, all the while remembering that there is history and legacy in everything black folks do. Just this Juneteenth, I've decided to raise the red, black, and green liberation flag in my yard. More than joy or pride, it is out of a sense of duty. I am reminded that sharing our history is also a transfer of black power to future generations. Now, the next page in Indie Week is often one a timeline of which I do not read. It's in sort of capsulated form and often contains a lot of graphics, but this one is about Juneteenth, and I will excerpt the some of the most important things that many of us don't even know about Juneteenth. And it begins in 1863. The Emancipation Proclamation goes into effect on January 1st at midnight, and it freed only states that seceded that weren't already under control by the Union. It was inspiring for the enslaved people living in the Confederacy, and paved the way for black men to join the Union military. Approximately 1 million people were still enslaved in the Union. 1865, Robert E. Lee surrenders the last major Confederate army at Appomattox, April 9th, effectively ending the war. June 19th, 1865, Union soldiers arrive at Galveston Bay, Texas, to inform some 250,000 enslaved people of the Emancipation Proclamation, 2.5 years after it went into effect, and 2 months after the end of the Civil War. The Texas decree from a Union general was known as General Order No. 3. Quote, "The people of Texas are informed that, in accordance with a proclamation from the Executive of the United States, all slaves are free. This involves an absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, and the connection heretofore existing between them becomes that between employer and hired labor. The freedmen are advised to remain quietly at their present home and work for wages. They are informed they will not be able to collect at military posts, and they will not be supported in idleness, either there or elsewhere. And this was the final decree of the Emancipation Proclamation. Texas was the last Confederate state to free its enslaved people, though slavery was still in effect in border states like Kentucky until the 13th Amendment was ratified on December the 6th that year. And the first celebration, called Jubilee Day, on June 19, 1866, was held in Texas. And there are several other important dates. And this can be found, of course, at IndyWeek.com if people want to know more details about this important date in national history. And now we'll move into some news columns. From Ellie Heffernan, we have new energy about an executive order from Governor Cooper and wind generation. North Carolinians love the coast for its beaches, but that's not all our shores are good for. Last week, Governor Roy Cooper issued an executive order that will bolster the state's efforts to expand offshore wind power production. The order establishes a goal of producing 2.8 gigawatts of wind power by 2030 and 8 gigawatts of wind power by the start of the following decade. This energy would power roughly 2.3 million homes by 2040. Governor Cooper said in a press statement, "Offshore wind power will help North Carolina create jobs and generate economic development while helping us transition to a clean energy economy. North Carolina's national leadership in clean energy and manufacturing, plus our highly trained workforce, create a strong business environment for offshore wind supply chain and manufacturing companies. North Carolina and the Triangle could attract much of the projected $100 billion national offshore wind market. The state has more offshore wind potential than any other along the Atlantic coast, according to a 2017 U.S. Department of Energy National Renewable Energy Lab report. Raleigh and Onslow Bay are some of the most promising locations for offshore wind energy. According to a 2009 study conducted by researchers at UNC Chapel Hill. This order also directs various state agencies to create new positions related to the offshore wind plan. The Department of Commerce must name a Clean Energy Economic Development Coordinator and establish a North Carolina Task Force for Offshore Wind Economic Resource Strategies, also known as NC Towers. The Department of Environmental Quality and Military and Veterans Affairs must designate offshore wind coordinators and take steps to support energy development. A North Carolina Offshore Wind Interagency Workgroup must also meet quarterly to ensure offshore wind activities are well coordinated among leadership in relevant agencies. A May report from the State Commerce Department forecasts that North Carolina could address and supply equipment for the entire East Coast offshore wind market, not just projects directly off the Carolina coast. The East Coast will likely see a total offshore wind capacity exceeding 40 gigawatts by 2035. North Carolina is well positioned to address this demand due to its multiple port and waterfront properties, according to the report, which was conducted by BVG Associates, a consulting company with extensive wind energy experience. The state's integrated, up-to-date, and high-capacity transport system also includes rail, road, and both inland and coastal waterways that connect easily to adjoining states and the coastline. Reaching the level of capacity projected by BVG will require a manufacturing ecosystem to supply component parts for at least 24 utility-scale wind farms. This means more jobs for North Carolinians. North Carolina already features one approved wind energy area, WEA, under lease for development. The Kitty Hawk WEA is projected to potentially support 2,500 megawatts of energy, enough to power approximately 700,000 homes. This is slightly under one-fifth of all households in the state. The state's new commitments to offshore wind energy will create jobs in a variety of sectors. Officials say, while helping achieve the North Carolina Clean Energy Plan's goals, which include a 70% reduction in power sector greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. North Carolina Commerce Secretary Michelle Baker Sanders said in a press release, "This coordinated approach to developing our offshore wind supply chain will bring new jobs to North Carolina for generations to come. From building out the supply chain, to installing equipment, to operating wind facilities, North Carolina's manufacturers and workforce are well positioned to play an integral role in the entire East Coast market." Now, Carol Espinoza-Jane from Raleigh put out, "James Upchurch has lived at Wayside Apartments on Garner Road in Raleigh for 8 years. The complex, located a few miles south of downtown, has served as affordable housing for many low-income residents for decades. But this month might be Upchurch's and the other residents' last living there. In mid-May, residents received a door notice that the complex had been sold and the new landlords would be terminating all leases, effective at the end of June, leaving Upchurch and dozens of others worried about housing. With Raleigh's average monthly rent for a 956-square-foot apartment estimated at $1,287, up 57% since 2010, the Wayside tenants filed a petition asking for their housing termination date to be extended. Upchurch says there's 32 families here that are being put out, so a couple of them have already found something. But me, I'm a handicapped individual, so I can't get around, and we're waiting to try to find something. The petition was sent to Trademark Residential, a residential management firm working for the complex's new owner, shortly after residents received the notices. Since then, many residents started contacting the Raleigh City Council and local activists for help. Diana Powell, executive director of Justice Served NC, says Upchurch contacted her about 2 weeks ago, shortly after he received the lease notice. Powell says, "This is the part where we have to come in and work together with our resources that are being funded and the community as well, and that's exactly what we're trying to do. If individuals find themselves totally with no support to go, no family, no couch, nowhere to go, then we as a community and these other programs must come together and figure it out." While tenants may reapply for housing in the renovated apartment complex, Powell says many of the new requirements set by the new landlords are difficult for current residents to meet. Rent, for example, is set to triple, and background and credit checks will now be part of the application process on top of an application fee. Powell says, "I would say probably 80% would not be able to continue to live there. Their options are just to find somewhere else or to become homeless." In a conversation with Indy, Upchurch said that while he could manage to afford the higher rent, he wouldn't be able to afford anything else. With the lease expiring soon, Upchurch contacted Corey Branch, the Raleigh City Council representative for District C, where this complex is located. Upchurch says, "I feel like he's trying, and they tell us that they're talking to the mayor. All I have to go on is what they tell us. All any of us have to go on is what they tell us." Branch says he has been in contact with several of the residents at the Garner Road apartment complex, as well as with Trademark Residential. Branch told Indy that the new landlords are working on ways to extend the housing deadline for current residents, but the residents still face challenges. since the housing market in Raleigh has not only become more expensive, but more competitive as well. Branch says, right now, because of the very low vacancy rate in the county, it's really challenging to find a place for anyone. For just someone moving here looking for a space, there's a lot of competing factors, so I think about that situation. But my overall goal is to work with the residents to keep them there. Ed Batchelor, the president of Trademark Residential, told Indy that the management firm is working with the Raleigh-Wake Partnership to End Homelessness to help the current residents find homes after the lease deadline. Batchelor also confirmed he's been working with Branch and the city council to find ways to house the residents. To combat the housing crisis, Branch says the city council is working on multiple affordable housing projects, including increasing Raleigh property taxes to cover upcoming affordable housing construction, but these complexes take months to build, Branch says. With the minimum wage in North Carolina still at $7.25 an hour, and the housing market expected to get more competitive in the coming years, many residents are finding the city of Oaks increasingly unaffordable. Branch says, we need more landlords that are willing to not go for the market rate, that are willing to say, hey, I can take a little less because I'm helping someone and that person is consistent with their payments. There's a lot of people who are willing to pay and consistently pay, but they can't afford the rate at which things are going or are increasing. According to Branch and Powell, the residents' June deadline is likely to be extended for a few more months. But residents who will be unable to meet the new housing requirements will now have to find backup plans for housing, and fast. For many, this means finding family, friends, or community groups who have space for them to temporarily reside, said Powell. As for Upchurch, he hasn't been able to find any tangible housing plans yet with his family. There ain't but three of us left at all, he says. One lives in Richmond, and I'm here. Tomasi McDonald's now with lawsuit season. Two Durham residents are suing the city and four council members for violating the state's open meetings law during a public appearance in which the members discussed funding cuts to the police department. At the crux of the complaint filed last week in Durham County Superior Court are claims that Mayor Pro Tem Jillian Johnson and fellow council members Javier Caballero, Charlie Reese, and Pierce Freeland violated the law by appearing together in a virtual town hall in which the members pledged to redirect 10% of the police department budget to alternative budgets. Four council members constitute a quorum, and by law, that would require advance public notice of the gathering. Two other council members and Mayor Steve Shule were not present at the town hall. The complaint was filed by Durham attorneys Daniel Meyer and Jonathan Jones on behalf of Deborah Friedman and Mark Roden. Durham City Attorney Kim Rayberg told the Indy that her office is evaluating the complaint. She wrote in an email, the city attorney's office needs an opportunity to review the complaint and discuss the allegation with our clients before publicly commenting on the substance of the suit. Based on what we know at present, again, without the benefit of conversation with our clients, I fully expect that we will present a vigorous defense against this lawsuit, and I look forward to presenting that defense in court. On May 17th, City Manager Wanda Page presented her proposed 2021-22 budget to the council. That proposal included the creation of a Department of Community Safety and the reallocation of five positions from the police department, including four officers. 3 days later, Johnson, Caballero, Reese, and Freelon appeared together at a virtual town hall, pledging to reallocate funds that had been earmarked for the hiring of 60 police officers. The event was hosted by Durham for All and the Durham Beyond Policing Coalition, according to the five-page complaint. The council has taken no action this year to significantly reduce the size of the police department or transfer resources to the not-yet-existent Department of Community Safety. According to the complaint, Johnston indicated, quote, she had a plan to reallocate 20 officer positions each year for the next 3 years to the Department of Community Safety, and Caballero, Freeland, and Reese all indicated agreement with Johnston's plan. The complaint claims irreparable injury to Freeman and Rodin, the plaintiffs, and the public at large, quote, through impairment of their knowledge and understanding of the people's business. The plaintiff's attorney, Meyer, said the open meetings law is quite broad in its definition of an official meeting. In an email to the Indy, he said, it goes well beyond voting to including deliberation and the transaction of public business. That's to prevent public bodies, such as the city council, from making decisions out of the public eye. There are very few circumstances where a majority of the city council can meet, and it would not be considered an official meeting. In this instance, 4 members of the council were discussing public policies and committing to vote in a particular way on an issue that was scheduled to come before them in just a few days. It is our contention that more than satisfies the requirements of an official meeting that requires proper notice and access to the general public. He added that open meetings laws may seem onerous, but they exist for a reason. It may not seem fair, said Meyer, that if 4 are friends, they can't get together for a cookout and discuss their plans, but they can't. It comes with the job and positions they chose to take. Meyer says his clients do not support the reallocation of positions from the police department to a new Department of Community Safety and don't understand why the city can't fund both the police positions as well as the new community department. But his client's position is irrelevant to the complaint, he said. Open meetings laws exist to protect against corruption, back office dealing, and control by special interests. He explained, this lawsuit is simply about making sure the city council conducts itself in accordance with the law. Despite the headlines, it's not in response to any particular policy position. Another column from Tomasi McDonald is the cover story on Indie Week from this issue, Haiti Reborn. Juneteenth, America's oldest national celebration commemorating the end of slavery, is experiencing a rebirth since the murder of George Floyd and the realization that the struggle for black freedom in America continues. This week, community organizers in Durham will host a Juneteenth celebration at the Haiti Heritage Center to acknowledge the end of one of humanity's most barbaric practices, which made white men rich and America a superpower. In addition to celebrating the end of slavery, the organizers of the June 18th event are touting the launch of a different kind of freedom, racial and economic equity, for the Haiti District, a culturally rich neighborhood along Fayetteville Street. That's one of the city's most historic communities. Haiti's Juneteenth will serve as the launching of a community-based initiative, Haiti Reborn, which aims to rebuild the community along the Fayetteville Street corridor. That community has languished for decades, still traumatized by urban renewal effort during the 1960s and early 70s with the construction of Highway 147. The misnamed initiative destroyed 4,000 homes and 500 businesses in the neighborhood. As previously reported by Indy, Henry McCoy, Director of Entrepreneurship at North Carolina Central University's Business School, believes the loss of Haiti's presence is incalculable, possibly billions of dollars in lost economic value. The Durham Juneteenth event will feature a major economic announcement about the Haiti District from McCoy. He said in an email to Indy, Haiti Reborn is just that. The vision is to see the rebirth of the community utilizing the same dynamic entrepreneurship ecosystem that it once was internationally known for. The vision is to see economic development within the community without forced displacements of residents. The vision is to build autonomous economic power such that Haiti's rebirth can serve as an inspiration for how we connect the black community to economic progress in contemporary times. The vision of Haiti Reborn is that the world can see the black community in Durham and beyond worthy of being invested in. The free event for the public will take place at the Haiti Heritage Center. That's 804 Old Fayetteville Street, formerly St. Joseph's AME Church, and will coincide with the old church building's 130th anniversary. The celebration will feature a Black Futures photo booth, capoeira workshops, karaoke, a Haitian dance workshop with live drumming, the Hillside High School drumline, two African dance ensembles, live jazz, and a tribute to Erzuli, the Haitian Mother Mary and Goddess of Love, whose veve, a religious symbol, has adorned the steeple of the Heritage Center for 130 years. The Haiti event is this Friday, that's tomorrow, 3 to 9 p.m. Interestingly, part of the event's celebration will pay tribute to the Haitian veve for Papa Legba, the spirit of the crossroads, who facilitates communication, which sits atop the William Robinson Science Building on the NCCU campus. Legba, sitting atop the science building, which was built in 1939, does not appear to be a happenstance occurrence. Both veves can be seen simultaneously while standing in front of the home of NCCU founder James E. Shepherd. The old church steeple appears to sit in the middle of Fayetteville Street, nearly a mile away. With the church's completion in 1891, roughly 90 years after the Haitian Revolution, one can only wonder if community leaders during that period were trying to transmit a message of self-sufficiency to future generations. The special Juneteenth presentation will be curated by Village of Wisdom, a Durham nonprofit that helps black parents help their children navigate racial bias in the classroom. Village of Wisdom partnered with Be Connected Durham, whose founder, Angel Dozier, says the Juneteenth celebration is part of a series of events titled Live from the Fayetteville Street Corridor that happen on the third Friday of each month at Haiti Heritage Center. The first event took place on March 19th. In addition to live jazz, speeches, and poetry, the events have featured vendors, black-themed art, and black-owned food trucks. Dozier says she designed the series to present critical cultural work like Village of Wisdoms to the broader community. Dozier describes the events as an alternative to Third Friday Durham in the downtown district, where art galleries and studios open their doors to the public to enjoy wine, cheese, and arts offerings. Dozier says, "Our neighbors have told us that downtown is not necessarily inclusive for them, so we are modeling what equitable engagement looks like." She says the irony of exclusion is that the genesis and origins of Durham's culture started in the Haiti neighborhood. They are the people who made that vibrancy happen, and now they are shut out. Her solution to feelings of exclusion? Start the third Friday events at the Haiti Heritage Center and eventually stage the event at other locations along the Fayetteville Street corridor, including W.D. Hill Recreation Center, Lincoln Community Health Center, North Carolina Central, and the Chicken Hut areas. The plan for this year's Juneteenth event, Dozier says, is to create a directory of artists, businesses, and vendors. She says, "We're going to take the same model to the Wellens Village and Bragtown neighborhoods. We aim to build business capacity and unity in the community." City Council member Didriana Freeman, whose constituents live in Haiti District, says a project to improve the economic fortunes of the community would have a positive impact on the entire city. She told the Indy, "Any work done in this economic climate that focuses on black and brown business would have an exponential impact on our local economy. The residential and commercial gentrification has devastated homeowners and businesses of color. We need targeted approaches that take history into account. McCoy says that during its heyday, the Haiti district was unparalleled, especially after the destruction of the Greenwood district in Tulsa, Oklahoma. McCoy says it was the undisputed center of black capitalism and entrepreneurship, the leading black Wall Street in America. It was known as the City on the Hill for Blacks and Capital of the Black Middle Class. He notes that Haiti was the home of North Carolina Mutual Insurance Company, the world's largest black-owned business for much of the 20th century, and that Durham had more black millionaires per capita than any other city in America at its apex. McCoy adds, one way to identify the economic and social strength of Haiti at its height is that in the midst of segregated Jim Crow South, Durham was a net gainer of black people, even as a great migration from the South was happening with blacks headed north. And the Haiti community produced one of the most diverse arrays of black entrepreneurial ecosystems in history, essentially covering every economic sector that whites were represented in. It's fitting that the launch of a community rebirth is taking place at Haiti Heritage. The old St. Joseph's AME Church building is one of Durham's finest architectural landmarks and was placed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1976. Prior to the building of the church, the site was the home of a brush arbor that served as the church's first sanctuary. The arbor was built by the church's founder, Reverend Edgen T. Markham. A log cabin house was then built on the site, which was also Durham's first black school, where Markham taught. According to a joint 2016 report by the city's Historic Preservation Commission and the City-County Planning Department, the old church was a, quote, center in the Haiti community and remains today as the last authentic physical reminder of early Haiti. Aya Shabu, Village of Wisdom's Director of Arts and Culture and Indie Voice columnist, says part of her role is to, quote, identify, celebrate, replicate, model, and create culturally affirming activities for the nonprofit's students, both inside and outside the classroom. The Juneteenth event itself is a classroom, she said. City Council member Mark Anthony Middleton says the Fayetteville Street corridor, quote, is not just a hotbed for black business and cultural activity. It is perhaps the most prominent approach to our downtown district. It should be considered the crown jewel in our city's crown and regarded with the same mystique and awe as Atlanta's Sweet Auburn and Harlem's Sugar Hill. Mayoral candidate Elaine O'Neill, a retired Durham Superior Court judge and former dean of the NCCU Law School, is scheduled to speak at the event. And she told the Indy, so much of the stuff that was good about us was there. When you look at it in its current condition, it does something to our psyche. And for it to come back to life is a rebirth in more ways than one. O'Neill, a lifelong Durham resident, was born at the old Lincoln Hospital on Fayetteville Street, about two blocks away from the Haiti Heritage Center. She told the Indy that Fayetteville Street was a connector for black people living all over Durham and who patronized restaurants like the near-legendary Green Candle or Chicken Hut that still stands. There was also the old Harriet Tubman YWCA, Mechanics and Farmers Bank, the Stanford Warren Branch Library, W.D. Hills, and nightclubs. There were mom and pop shops, prominent churches, and striking homes of the community's leading citizen, all crowned by the flagship educational institution, Hillside High School, and NCCU. O'Neill says, it was like the gateway street. We want Fayetteville Street to be a change agent for Durham. Well, I turn the page to a column that doesn't often appear called Etc. And this longish article is about professional putt-putt. They came from high... Oh, excuse me. It's written by Brian Howe. They came from High Point and Charlotte, from Virginia and South Carolina, from Kentucky and Pennsylvania. They wore cotton caps, cotton pants, and Under Armour polo shirts. They were about 90 in number, a far-flung yet close-knit society coming together, as they had so many times before, to make a new champion. They brought their own clubs. Their arena was the pair of miniature golf courses at the Putt-Putt Fun Center in Burlington, which has been on North Church Street since 1962. On the weekend of June 5 and 6, it hosted the Professional Putters Association's annual PPA Invitational Tournament and its amateur counterpart, the APA. During the penultimate round on Sunday afternoon, the unrelieved sun made the mini golf franchise's distinctive orange trim and green carpets appear to blaze. But the play was cool and methodical. Shows of agony were restrained to soft groans and dark laughs, though camaraderie was evident in the back slaps and shoulder squeezes that passed among these men who reunited a few times a year somewhere in America to do their favorite thing. Though each competed alone, they played in pairs. They kept their own scores, with only their fellow putters and a few family members to cheer them on. Here was Graham Sigman, a polite, sun-pinked 12-year-old from Madison, North Carolina. Despite his young age, he finished mid-pack, just a few places behind his dad in the amateur division. It was won by Earl Davis, whose brief speech about his emotional final hole was warmly received. He was the only African-American player in the tournament, which was otherwise composed almost entirely of white men of at least middle age. Here was Ken Hastings of Pittsburgh, who has been crisscrossing the country for PPA events with his friend John Bambling for 50 years. Neither of them did so well, but Hastings didn't seem to mind. He said of Bambling, "He's heard all my jokes 77 times, and he still gives me a chuckle. We do it because we love the game." Here was Joe Aboyd, the PPA's commissioner since 1985, who has the shorn pate, kind eyes, and tired, patient voice of a beloved college professor. He gave up competitive play when he went to work for the company and got more interested in making sure the carpets were clean than in scoring an ace. He sold his course in Virginia a few years ago and now just runs the tournaments, a volunteer position. And here was owner-operator Brian Patterson, a youthful 48-year-old Burlington native whose clean, well-kept courses have earned the PPA's respect. When he drove down to Fernandina Beach, Florida, for the PPA championship last year, he wanted to see the oldest putt-putt in existence. But he had another motive, too. He wanted to ask Aboyd, who allocates tournaments to the dwindling number of official PPA putt-putt courses that remain, for one more chance to host one. In the week before the tournament, Patterson announced to the PPA community that would be his last before he sold his business, the only place he's ever worked, other than a couple of teenage jobs, to a new owner, a man from Maryland named John Wilder, in August. Besides Patterson retirement, the talk of the tourney was Randy Reeves, an Alabaman who broke a PPA record by scoring 26 consecutive holes in one. But in the last round, all eyes were on Greg Newport of South Carolina and Kevin Rutledge of Tennessee, who were locked in a close battle and who had history. Newport knew the course well and had won several tournaments before. Rutledge had never played in Burlington or won a national tournament, though he had often lost to Newport by a single stroke. When Newport's daughter found Rutledge practicing, he said, "Tell your daddy not to worry. He'll still beat me by one." But after the underdog from Tennessee aced the 17th, taking a daring route in between a pair of metal triangles, the friendly rivals tied, initiating a playoff, 18 holes one-on-one. With everyone else, Brian Patterson drew in close to watch. Don Clayton founded Putt-Putt in Fayetteville in 1954, deep in the post-war leisure boom. The company once had more than 300 franchises around the world, though now it's down to a few dozen in the South and East, with outposts in Texas and California. Among brands so iconic that they become proper nouns, it is unique. Whereas a Kleenex really is just a facial tissue, Putt-Putt is not just mini-golf. Beyond the family fun lies a schematic no-frills game geared for technical, competitive play. The PPA, which Clayton founded under a different acronym in 1959, competes exclusively on Putt-Putt courses. This was one of two national tournaments. The other, larger one, will be in Richmond, Virginia in September, that it runs for dues-paying members each year. The competitors had already proven their mettle on the local circuit and earned the cosign of a trusted operator like Patterson. The top prize in Burlington was $1,200. The greens were outlined by orange bump boards and dotted with orange obstacles, simple bricks, triangles, discs, posts, and brackets, all made of the same extruded aluminum, which gives a consistent bounce. The holes, each a par two, on which a hole-in-one is possible, were hidden in plain sight, resting on curves or behind angular scoops. It's all by the book of regulation designs that the company dispenses to franchisees. Patterson says, "It's not like when you say, let's go play putt-putt at Myrtle Beach. We pride ourselves on it being more of a skill-based game, as opposed to just hoping you get lucky and hit the ball in a clown's mouth." As a kid, Patterson liked coming to Super Saturdays, when you could play all the putt-putt and video games you wanted for a flat fee. In the beginning, it's not that he was all that ardent about mini-golf. He just liked being there, goofing off, and eating pizza. As a high school junior, he needed a part-time job. His uncle was a putt-putt manager, so he got one there. He started as an attendant in the game room, where tokens, plastic prizes, and games of mini-golf changed into one another in an endless loop of small rewards. When he went to UNC Charlotte, he kept coming back to work at the putt-putt on weekends. After one semester there, and a few nearer to home, his upslope momentum ran out, and his life rolled back into the hole it had been bound for all along. He said, "When I quit college, I was like, all right, Brian, you gotta figure out what you're gonna do with your life. If you like working at Putt-Putt, let's ask owner Bobby Gilmore if you can be his manager. Try to learn the trade and see where it goes." After several years as a manager, Patterson bought the business in 2001. Now he's also a married father of two teenage boys, one of whom will be among the dozen employees he brings on this summer, when camp and daycare kids will pour through by the busload. But during slower times, he's often the only one there. When Patterson bought this franchise, it had already adapted to the arcade boom and subsequent crash of the 1980s and 90s. He has weathered the 2008 economic crash by shortening off-season hours and the coronavirus pandemic by sheer luck and dedication. He says, laughing, "I'm just thinking I've had enough putt-putt fun and it's time to have a midlife crisis and change gears. I'd really like to find myself in something a little more lucrative and easier on my body. People think I'm just standing behind the counter selling putt-putt, but there's a lot more to it. The painting, pressure washing, mowing and blowing and weeding, scrubbing bathrooms." He'll miss the place, the people, and the local celebrity. He said, "It's kind of cool when you go out in town and kids go, 'Mommy, that's the putt-putt guy.'" But inasmuch as putt-putt is about doing the same thing in the same way in the same place again and again, deceptively simple obstacles can be hard to overcome, and apparently unshakable patterns can suddenly change. "Do your thing, rut," someone yelled before the 16th hole of the playoff. Newport took practice swings in the grass nearby. A little girl ran by, wearing plastic fangs from the arcade. Whitney Houston's "How Will I Know" played softly on the PA. Rutledge skimmed it twice for a bogey, bringing his rival within range before rallying to defeat Newport by one stroke. A few minutes later, Rutledge was among the well-wishers who came to embrace him, but the crowd was already thinning out. Some people had very long drives, and anyway, most of them would see each other in Richmond in the fall. All right, for our cultural sections, we'll begin with an interview from a music column called Behind the Lens. It's by Keisha Jennings, and it's about Raleigh hip-hop videographer Patrick Lincoln. If you live in the Triangle area and are immersed in the hip-hop community, you've probably heard of Torch House Media, a, quote, full production house that creates content at the cornerstone of culture. The company is founded by Patrick Lincoln, a videographer based in Raleigh, known for his level of professionalism and his eye for perfection, who has worked with high-profile clients like HBO, PBS Rock Nation Jamla artist Rhapsody, and a host of other Carolina artists. Recently, the Indie spoke with Lincoln to learn more about his career trajectory and goals with film production. This is written in a question-answer format. Indie, what inspired you to get into videography? Was the goal always to shoot music videos? This may sound very cliche, but movies have always been a huge part of my life. It was always a way of bonding with my father, who introduced me to the classics at a very early age. Then in high school, I took a visual arts class that really dissected the symbolism in certain films and gave me a glimpse of the behind-the-scenes process. Music videos were definitely the goal when I was first starting out. I used to sit in my room and research local artists for hours and send them all messages, hoping someone would give me a chance without any body of work to show besides some old GoPro edits. Did you receive formal training? My aunt recommended a program called Film Connection, which was very new at the time. It was a 2-year program that allowed you to be a student remotely. They would also reach out to production companies in your area to place you in an internship. I was at Uptone Pictures for 2 years before deciding to give freelancing a shot. Uptone gave me a foundation of skills, but I learned most of what I know now by throwing myself into the fire and failing many times. YouTube was also, and still is, a huge source to learn filmmaking. You do a really good job branding on social media. Where did that skill set come from? I honestly have always thought I didn't do enough on social media, so I appreciate you saying that. It's very reassuring. My only goal for my account was to be myself and come across as approachable. I had a friend early tell me that the way I presented myself on social media was going to prevent any corporate clients from reaching out, and I was fine with that. Who are some of the Triangle artists you've worked with? I started offering free concert recap videos for local artists to get my foot in the door. They would just be 1-minute highlights, but it was the perfect opportunity to develop a certain style and gain exposure in the community. At one of these shows, I met Zen So Fly, and we hit it off. She was gracious enough to allow me to film and edit her video for Getting Started. That was my first music video, and things kind of took off from there. I've been lucky to work with so many talented artists in North Carolina, whether it was from a recap or a music video. People like Young Bull, Pat Jr., Nance, G. Yamazawa, Ruben Vincent, Cooley High, Boulevards, Lauren Reed, Jew's Lord, Lord Fess, Reckon Crew, and so many others. Super grateful for all of them trusting me over the years. Many of them I'm still working with and consider friends. I noticed that you recently began working with Jamla Rhapsody. What was that experience like, especially in the midst of racial injustice and police brutality? Did you have creative input, and are you aware of the criticism the video received on social media? Rhapsody's creative energy is off the charts and extremely contagious to be around. This started a marathon of working together, which then led to her asking me to direct the video for her new track, 12 Problems. Rhapsody came into the office shortly after and presented all her ideas for the concept. She knew exactly what she wanted, and it was our job to execute. This was my largest project to date, and I was definitely nervous, but also confident that someone of Rhapsody's caliber was trusting me with her vision. I doubt I noticed all of the criticism online, but we completely understood there would be passionate opinions about the subject from both sides. I knew there were some heated exchanges in the YouTube comments, but starting those conversations was kind of the point. Who are some videographers, filmmakers that you admire? I'm always inspired by directors who are also incredible editors. The ones who stand out to me are Omar Jones and Lone Wolf. They both have super unique styles and are just killing it right now. Around here, I really look up to what Summit Collective produces. Everything they work on is impressive. I've been lucky enough to work with a couple of their members on recent projects. I also got to give shout-outs to Andrew Kennedy, Ryan Pham, and Brandon McCarroll. Where do you see yourself and your company in 5 years? Although I love working on music videos, it would be nice to dedicate more time towards other avenues of filmmaking, documentaries, short films, features, commercials, television, all of it. Now, as our time on air diminishes very quickly, there's just three more things that I need to mention in this issue of Indie Week. One is Thomas E. McDonald's revisiting Jackie Shelton Green wrenching poetry collection called I Want to Undie You, which was recently translated to Italian. Jackie Shelton Green was one of North Carolina's poet laureates. The third woman to serve as North Carolina Poet Laureates. And they are wrenching. And this article is probably worth reading. Unfortunately, I don't have time to do that now, nor do I have time to review two CDs, Noah Deemer, The Sleepwalker, and Brutal Junior, Party Garbage, which was, says the headlines by these two reviewers, two new albums drift through disorienting dreamscapes and gritty, glitchy dystopias. Oh, here comes our cicada combo buzzing their way back into our studio. They're munching our donuts and they're climbing into the mixing board. Well, don't they play nice anyway? Still, I think we will feature a different group in the future. Well, John Federson for the North Carolina Reading Service will be back next week reading Indie Week and hope to get to you then. So long for now.